Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
World Atlas of Cheese by Nancy Urquhart-Stork, a 1976 cheese classic. Many people will prize this book, travel a long distance for it, and valuably prize it. We can store it in a very safe safe place, and it sort of captures the world of the 1970s, well, before the 1970s, in a point of time where we really wanted to work out what was going on. There was lots of change, but cheese was a sort of constant which had sort of carried through its development and was used in many ways, and that a cheese marketer had a good view of the world, and she definitely wrote about it and brought it to life. We've done the basics of cheese, the continental map of European cheese, and now we're working our way in sort of like a paintbrush stroke across Europe, firstly from Norway up to Sweden, Finland, then across Denmark, across to Iceland, then back to England, England, for some reason, England, then back to Ireland. Ireland was dismissed because the Celts weren't very good lovers of cheese. Then, just when we thought we couldn't get worse or better, we hit Holland. And then Holland is great, but then you have these things of these people with cheese markets with different coloured hats around, walking around the place. I'll just read you the caption for it. The sleds which carry the cheese are similarly coloured. The market is only held during the summer on Friday mornings. So these cheese markets and all these people in white coats come out with hats and tourists watch them manipulate cheese. We also found that the Dutch people are called kaas kop. Kaas is the Dutch for cheese. Cheese, kaas. And kop is head. Totem kop or death heads. Kaas kop. Because they used to wear cheese molds as helmets during the riots. We don't know why they were rioting. as a helmet was often used during riots. There's a little picture here of the old method of kneading Leiden cheese. This is a quote. It has never been established which suffered most, the farmer's feet or the cheese. So the farmer used to stand and use his feet for the cheese. The modern methods are still occurs a lot of problems. And then there's all this, you know, Dutch cheese is the best. But there is this fantastic cheese, which was an accident. This knife sticker rotten cheese was resaved. It was sticky, disgusting, but they liked it. And I don't know whether it is. And there's heaps of controls, and Holland is well-controlled cheese superpower. So this is a cheese superpower from the 1976. Of course, I think other countries will be massively investing in their cheese to compete with Holland. Okay, now we come to the next section, which is Belgium and Luxembourg. And I'll find out a lot more about Belgium. And of course, Belgium is just totally destroys Holland now, because I can see a few hills and there's cows up in the hills. And that's the picture. Cows grazing in the meadow of the Belgian Ardennes. Frisian cattle, together with its white or blue spotted breed, found all over central southern Belgium. The white breed represents about half the cattle stock of the country. Belgian postage stamps dating before the Second World War joined to the official Dutch cheese stamp control stamp. And then there's Hollanders Kaas, so the Dutch for cheese, there's the Danish for cheese, the Norwegian for cheese, which I've forgotten, that's at the end, and the Dutch for cheese is now Kaas. Let's see if I can just re-remember. British cheese is cheese, Great Britain. Right, it's Ost. Now, halfway through this, there's some cheese facts which I brought out from my study of philosophers, and the Inquisition features in the cheese. Some was burnt, the second last person burnt at the stake by the Inquisition. The actual papal Inquisition was a cheesemaker, and we'll talk about him a bit later on, especially when I think we get down to Italian cheese. I'll tell that story. In the Middle Ages, the southern Netherlands occupied most of the area which is now Belgium, as a major centre of trade and commerce. Most international routes over land were see met in Bruges, but towards the close of the 4th century, Antwerp began to overtake Bruges. The city became a great trading point for Spanish, English, wool, French, wine, Portuguese, Dutch, butter and cheese, Scandinavian wood, and fish and flax in surrounding districts. No dairy produce of any consequence was produced in the southern provinces of the lowland bordering the North Sea. Even though the ground there was fertile enough, there was more money to be made from arable farming for those traders who supported and propped up the country's living standards. Neither was the cows hardly thought of as a producer of milk. Unlike sheep and goat, the farmers used cattle for pulling the plough, the source of manure rather than milk and cheese. As everything in family, it's a matter of carefully judging and farming its judging economics. So it is rather remarkable here that Holland is not the greatest country. It's just the fact that it was a country where cheese was just right for it. Cheese from a crisis. Oh, there you go. Serious problems affecting agriculture at the end of the 19th century, forcing drastic changes in Belgian farming, especially in the wheat lands, following the fall of grain prices. That's interesting. That may actually cause some sort of problem. I was trying to think. Wars and things like that. Oh, here we go. Farmers turned to cattle breeding. The economic value of meat, milk and other dairy produce soon rose. The cows quickly left the sheep and goats well behind. Although Belgian farmers maintained their agrarian traditions, they began to pay careful attention to cattle breeding. This combined with good feeding soon increased the milk yield. Before 1900, the first dairy factory had been established, mainly for processing butter. After the Second World War, more factories were built, and cheese began to produce. New cheese factories were constructed to meet the growing demand, and existing plants were modernised. Until the mid-1960s, Belgium's main production was centred on semi-hard cheese for Gouda and Sampurl variety, but a change to the national preference led to the rehabilitation of the original Belgian soft cheeses. Well, there you go. Belgium, sitting right next to the cheese epicentre, just didn't do it. The return of the farmhouse cheese. The most famous of all Belgian cheeses is, or rather was, the Limburger, famous for its persistent omnipotent aroma. It was made in the Liège region and sold in Limburg, but has now been most totally superseded by the Herve cheeses. The Limburger itself having been adopted by the Germans, who made considerable quantities. Although the Limburger failed to make a comeback, a Renaissance farmhouse of farmhouse cheeses is well established. Among them, other types are Rameau, Brussels Cass, Fromage en Pain, and Plat Cass, or curd cheese. Herve comes from the grazing area of that name, north of the province of Liège, a rolling, stretching of country between Verdes and Meuse. It's hard to think these entire countries fit within Australian cattle farms. So we've got a few capital stations, a few farms as big as these countries. They're all owned by the Chinese at the moment, but the name comes from the Walloon word remold, or roughly after milk. It's made from the milk that the cow gives at the end of the lactation period, when the milk is very rich in fat. With the introduction of artificial insemination, cows are continuously productive and never dry at the same time. Oh, right. So you can get them pregnant off-season. That's the thinking. Amazing. I didn't think of that. The preparation of herve begins with the pouring of warm raw milk into a cheese. This is called stinking cheese, a herve. So they really make a stenching cheese. Oh, my God. Called tarn, a word found in both in Dutch and Norwegian, where, with the aid of a little rennet, it thickens within 1.5 hours. After a rest period, its perforated pot or colander is placed on the curd. spot fills with whey. Okay. And 40 to 50% is ladled off. The next stage introduces the traditional spatenfell, a large draining board, which is around about 6 inches high, divided lengthwise by planks to form gutters, down which the whey runs to be drained through apertures. The entire contraption made by local craftsmen is built on a stand so that it slopes to allow drainage. The cheesemaker pours the wet curd from the pan quickly and evenly along the gutters until they are completely filled. The whey is drained off. The longitudinal strips of curds are turned through 90 degrees with a practiced deft movement of the cheesemaker's arms. The curd rests while further whey is drained off. This process is repeated 3 times. I knew it would be 3 times. It wouldn't be just enough. So that's 90 degrees 3 times. It's actually put through to 70 degrees all up. Then cut into cubes, placed back into the spatenfell between the planks, now arranged to form a rectangle division. The vise is turned regularly by hand for the next 48 hours. Air currents in the room must be avoided, as they would spoil the newly made cheese.
Gosh, this is the most incredibly complex cheese.
In the old days, the cheesemaker would then place the cheese next to one another on the cheese board, where they would be treated by dusting with salt. But today, a special sorting table is used. Unripe cheeses are collected by the so-called affineurs, who take them from the farm to their substation, where the cheeses are washed and treated again with salt and lukewarm brine. Due to this process, and also the damp air in the processing room, the initially hard, chalk-white cheese becomes soft and smooth, while ripening bacteria present on the reddish-brown rind imparts an outstanding aroma and penetrating flavour, especially with the Romanou, which has earned the dubious nickname the Stinking Cheese. Well, so I'll tell you what the Stinking Cheese is, so you don't say, I'd like to buy some Stinking Cheese. You wouldn't imagine this in the supermarket, because that would, you couldn't store all these cheeses together. R-E-M-O-U-N-D-O-U. The final packing shape is a cube measuring 6 centimetres by 6 centimetres. Factory-made Romanou, like so many mass-produced cheeses, uses pasteurized instead of raw milk, and the refining process that takes place in the factory or on the premises of the affineurs. The method of manufacture, as used in traditional craftsmen, can be seen in Musée de Rendezvous, a museum devoted to cheese, especially established by the Seigneurie Folklorique de Romanou. Well, bloody hell. I think I've been in Europe and I haven't made a beeline to this factory. So for you, if you're in Belgium, if you ever listen to this in Germany, I know people listen to this occasionally in Germany, if you are in Germany, hop in your Volkswagen or Porsche, make a beeline to R-E-M-O-U-D-O-U. And there's a cheese museum, or was in 76. It may have closed down, or it may have become digitized, or it may have become millions of dollars investment. And who knows? I'll have to check that. The premises are the ripening cellars of an old cheese factory in Batisse, close by the town of Herve, to the east of Liège. The seigneuries kept the rightful fame of real old Mourou alive in more than one sense. The odour of the famous stinky cheese is impregnated in the stones of the museum. Okay. The cheese of Flanders and the South. A variety of washed cheeses is the plateau cheese, with a consistency that is somewhere between soft and semi-hard during the ripening, and the rind is kept mostly by regularly damping it with fresh water. In Flanders, Platikas, fresh curd cheese, is a type that includes many fresh, unripened varieties cheeses with different fat contents, according to the amount of cream added. The skim milk cheese is less than 20% fat. Semi-fat has 20% to 35%. Full fat from 35% to 45%. Cream cheese is more than 45% fat in dry matter. Oh, I didn't know that cream cheese is really fatty, is it? if it was healthy for you. French speaking part of the country has its own fresh cheeses, fromage en panier, fromage en cassette. And these are still made in limited amounts in southern Belgium from either buttermilk or skim milk or whole milk, and sold in small baskets covered with walnut leaves, of course. Often the curd is flavoured with pepper. Belgians enjoy eating this cheese on toast, with a layer of butter on the cheese, a local delicacy. In fact, Belgians are great eaters who have invented some classics, and filling soups and stews and dishes that include cheese. I love the cheese. I would have a cheese soup. I can't believe it. Excuses for festivals and communal feasts are not exactly numerous, but when they do arise, the quantities of food that appear are prodigious. Plates are overfilled with cold cuts of assorted meats, sausages, selections of cheeses, breads, wine and beer, and especially beer. This a scene straight from Blücher painting is enacted every 3 years in the town of Winschheim, south of Bruges. Well, that's another thing. So let's go, the town that you also have to go to every 3 years is Winschene, south of Bruges. The local residents honour the painter by dressing in the costume of the period, and members of several guilds, bakers, butchers, brewers and cheesemakers, present their products to the general enjoyment of all. What a place. Well, there's the town, there's the fromagerie du Plateau de Herve. It's a little place. It doesn't look as though it's got a lot of parking outside. No gift shop at this stage in 76. Other cheeses from Belgium and Luxembourg. The most typically Belgian cheese is the Brussels cheese, and the Hettikas, which is made in two phases when pasteurized skimmed milk. The collagen mass is cut into small blocks, and in the 12-hour rest period that follows, they contract, acidify, and release whey. Afterwards, this fresh curd is put into sacks and placed on a grid to drain. The curd is then ground, salted, and moulded in the shape of metal hoops. The cheeses must be laid out flat onto planks to drain further, and then on a rush mat to dry. The second phase is complicated because it allows the cheeses to ripen for 2 months in a humid ripening room. Every 8 days, they are dipped and turned in lukewarm water and then finally in bran bath. Cheeses are then cut into pieces and packed in cellophane. Yet another bathing and draining treatment is packed in boxes or plastic containers. The end product is very moist and salty and very much to the national taste. Finally, Belgium produces imitation foreign cheeses, including Gouda, Edam, and Epital, for the export market, large quantities of cheddar, Camembert, Brie, and Saint Paulin. In Luxembourg, cheese industry concentrate mainly on fresh types, like, I wonder how big the Luxembourg cheese range is, like fromage blanc, cottage cheese, and crux fromage circuit. Okay. C-A-C-H-K-E, approximately E-S, fromage cuit, a cheese that can be favourably compared with Chantenelle and French Comte. The quality of Belgian hard cheeses types is guaranteed by regular official inspection. 2 favourable judgments out of 3 inspections allow the cheese to carry the mark denoting quality, stamped in purple ink on the rind, plus the Belgian emblem, Belgian picture of 2 partners bearing a pile of various cheeses on a plank. I don't see the actual picture. With this beautiful 1960s picture left. In the monastery of Lest, cheese is sold by the monks. It's sample and type, which has been prepared in the cloisters since ancient times. And there's a monk and this person with this amazing... You remember those hairdos? Those beehive hairdos? This is a slightly, but not sort of glamorous person with a beehive hairdo. There is France, which goes on and on and on. Oh, Germany gets a gander, but France goes from page 76 to we've got 20 pages of French. Oh. So it's 76 to 93. That's a 4 and a 3. That's 27 pages of French cheese. So I might leave that later and tell you I suppose a story from cheese making, which sort of really, really picks up. Now, I'll just put this in the context of looking at overall knowledge acquisition. Obviously from rehabilitation, from a different training, I've got these two different paths coming into a different attitude to knowledge. That's where you're sort of aware of your knowledge, aware of the knowledge itself. It's been distributed and you do a lot of research in it, a study period. And so what I've realized is that in knowledge production, you have these processes, three sort of separate processes, which for some reason the way that people approach it, they don't have it. And you've got the study, which I'm doing at the moment, deduction, which where you get two facts and compare them, produce a third. You can see me applying deduction to try and work out things or to cross-check. So deduction is associated when you're embedding the studied knowledge, and then induction. So induction would be with where I actually go out and start to experiment with cheeses, either by buying them, tasting them, visiting places, and I would gather some life experiences to add into it. And so and then I've spent about an hour describing this last night. You've got these things, these behavioural things where people will have behavioural social things where they will pick up knowledge and favour it or not, depending on their social conditioning. And so a lot of people may not read the World Atlas of Cheese from 1976, and good on them. But you've got to be in the right frame of mind to enjoy almost anything, like one of those stinking cheeses. You've got to get over the fact that it's stinking, or get over the fact that a Dutch man who's walking around the place has actually used his feet to do some curl. If he's in Leiden, you never know. So there are all these facts that you've got, these unusual facts that people tend to challenge, and because they are acquiring facts with a behaviour paradigm behind them, that is, that it's whether they have a fact reflects on them, not the facts themselves, and the fact that they have a say will affect their social surroundings. So their interaction with a particular group of facts is dominated by these other what appear to extraneous factors, i.e. what people will think of them for spending their time looking at it, and what people will think of them for actually saying a fact. So people attribute a fact to the person and their belief system. And so if you say a fact, that person is quite a challenging person, because you're in that fact, on that fact interaction, which is very behaviour oriented, which is a long distance from the broad research space. So it's not unsurprising that I've picked up. And now the other aspect is that there's this behavioural thought that all factors are contained within a region, so all cheese facts are the same. But looking into it, we see different things. We see, looking through this, we've got a window into the Dutch marketing bureau, a window into the world of 1976. You know, view of the world in terms of values going through here. We've got little windows into countries which have their dirty secrets of cheese, and that Dutch people are called cheesehead, cask task cops. What a fantastic thing. Because they actually did wear cheese moulds on their head. You know, it's these sorts of things which go through. But then you get the beautiful story of Havarti cheese and how it's made and why it's the way it is. But it's the it's a story, a romantic story of this woman making her way in the cheese world, but we've sort of just forgotten it. You can see here to get things down. So let's look at the cheese and worm cosmology. So there was a cheese maker, right, who was perhaps senile or had some sort of mental disorder, and he believed that in a cheese and worms cosmology, and all this is in deep dark memory. He was in context of researching Bruno. So Bruno was this amazing person with as I now know, a fantastic memory. Good on you, Bruno. And he used to go around Europe upsetting people, I think, a little bit with his memory or his... I can sort of see how it happens, Bruno. So Bruno is this fantastic person who said, look, other stars have planets around them. Like, this is just the most incredible thought. There are other worlds, many worlds, and Bruno eventually said enough distressing things which happened to be true, but not based on logically truth. He just happened to speculate forward in truth, and he essentially forced the church to burn him in St. Peter's Square, I think in 1599, around the time. Just enough time to give Galileo a real scare and everyone in Europe a real scare. But looking into it, he was determined to get himself burnt for some reason. I just can't all figure it together. He's one of these really interesting figures which don't fit together. And now, in terms of knowledge, he had a big knowledge, eclectic knowledge, bringing different areas of thought together and producing things. So, in a sense, he is a classic martyr for the behavioural control of knowledge. He was not behaving properly, and so he actually could say things which upset people. Now, before him, there was one other person who was burnt, and what would happen is that the inquisitions, I think there's people who have studied inquisitions say that there are 11 inquisitions. So inquisitions are things set up by the church / state to inquire and determine whether someone was a heretic or producing heretical ideas and therefore challenging or putting the threat of people's souls. Souls in. This is before Reformation, although you can see a lot of problems coming up. And so these things would, these people would, at one place, you read about it and you get a bit more detail. It's not just the people snitching. They would stand up and inspect your cart, coming along, they get tip off, inspect your cart, read your books, work out, sort of get you to explain things. And there's a whole lot of understanding here that without emails and stuff like that, people still relied on margin notes and things that you said, because what you said was who you were, and we're still we haven't left that place at the moment. If I say an opinion, that's me, and you can punish me and put me to jail for it. So it's, you can still that we have, but back then it was much more there. I'm just putting it in. And if the people were losing control, they would call up inquisitions to come in and sort things out. So inquisitions were sort of like a holy royal commission that we have here. So in Australia, when the regulations, the banks and everything doesn't really work, and no one's, there's sort of a clutch of corruption, the royal commissions come in. And they ask questions and make recommendations and take testimonies and sort of stop play coming in. And so In northern Italy, there were still pagan groups, even into the Renaissance. So there were, on Sundays, Catholic. The rest of the day, they were believing these things. And so they had this problem of witches. And the witches would apparently get on their broomsticks and have fights in the air at night by the moon and stuff like that. And the the Inquisition was used to this type of thing, would come in and not give too much credence of it, settle everything down and let these things die a natural death. They wouldn't come in and start burning people and martyring people. They knew who they were going for. It's just that people, when they were concerned by this, and they said, oh, and look, by the way, we've got to drag this person up before you. He has said that the cosmos has nothing to do with Genesis and the Bible. It's indeed that the universe is a huge amount of cheese, and the worms inside the cheese represent the angels. All this complex stuff, and you can imagine them not listening to us and not really understanding. And I said, well, the that thinks that, well, no punishment, but yeah, you're going to have to stop saying. So it's like a police warning, a caution, huge caution. And the wife was one of the people bringing this cheesemaker up, and they said, no, do you agree not to say the cheese and worms cosmology? And what happened is that that the commission went away, and this person began to start up again, and people flocked to this cheese and worms cosmology. And this cheese, at this time, you can imagine these aspects of cheese making are rather lost. That there are cheeses in Britain which used to have mites, various insects involved in the cheese making process, not just bacteria. Of blue mold, of red and things like that, or bacteria which is grown into the floor of your cheese factory, you wouldn't do that. And I suppose looking at this, one of the things you find out with cheese is that besides the wide variety of bacteria, the wide variety of tastes, there's a wide variety of people and markets which can adapt to the eating the most disgusting cheeses I could ever imagine to come across. So this person, and you have to understand the Middle Ages, reading this, is that people are not educated slightly mentally ill. You've got this combination of things, and society has adjusted to it, that they just try mentally ill people, and they're not too aware of either the popes being uneducated or the actual people being uneducated, that they're blissfully unaware of it. They think they're as good as anybody else, or someone's educated is beyond their ability to understand. So this person comes up and says, matter of fact, after saying I would never do it again, it is true. And they said, you're going to keep persistent? Yes. Okay, well, we'll have to burn you. And they burnt him. So this is a cheese and worms cosmology. You can look that up on the internet. And, you know, is it true? It's hard to know. Thanks a lot for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.